Today's episode of Political Dominoes was recorded, actually, a few days ago. So if you hear me talking about the Helsinki Summit as if it happened today, on the day that you're listening to this podcast, well, my apologies. Shouldn't affect the overall content, though, and we hope you enjoy. I had wanted to do a show a couple weeks ago about the election of Recep Tayyip Erdogan to the presidency of Turkey. I thought there was a lot of, valuable background information that might make his ascendance to the presidency there in Turkey, contextualized and interesting and digestible. It's a word I like very much to describe how someone who is a consumer of media in the year 2018 can go about thinking about what to tackle and what not to tackle. There are some things out there today that just don't seem to fit quite well into a framework that someone can use to build their perspective on global politics or even domestic politics here in the United States. But as happens sometimes, life came up, technical difficulties, etc., prevented me from going back and talking about Kemal Ataturk or the fall of the Ottoman Empire after World War I. I couldn't talk about his secularization program, which, given the background, which is the Ottoman Empire and its reign in that part of the world for centuries, it's very interesting, something worth taking into account, especially when considering that Recep Tayyip Erdogan, I'm going to just refer to him as Erdogan from now on, as Erdogan, throughout his career, has challenged this notion of a secular Turkish state. Because, Recep Tayyip Erdogan at one point, not too long ago, was barred from practicing politics at all in Turkey, given his commitment to Islam as a proper mode of politics in Turkey. And as I sit here talking about Kemal Ataturk and Erdogan, I'm brought back to the fact that that show's been scrapped. That show's not going to appear. Recep Tayyip Erdogan is going to go on serving as president of Turkey, whether or not I publish a show specifically about that. Pretty clear, pretty reasonable. But the thing that also kept me back from publishing that podcast I'm referring to is not just life, it's the news cycle. If the current news cycle wasn't this rocket ship towards nowhere, which is basically how I see the news cycle over the course of the last 2 or 3 years, then maybe we would have had time to meditate on Erdogan and what his election, re-election, means. But no, we have to move on, and for good reason. I understand that what happened in Helsinki, Finland, that will be capturing the interests of many geopolitical minds around the globe, and for good reason. Who remembers the election of Recep Tayyip Erdogan today? Today being the day that President Putin of Russia and President Donald Trump of the United States met in Helsinki, Finland. And this brings me to another personal problem that I have when thinking about, producing podcasts and talking about the news and talking about global politics. How do you wade into the political water? Ocean is a better word. How do you wade into the political ocean when, you're a newcomer like me and Donald Trump is the biggest fish in the global pond? A disruptive fish at that. Not by, as my opinion holds, not by really any doing of his own intellectual ability to stir up the world, at least intentionally in the way he has specifically. You get so many qualifiers when you start to talk about your personal opinion of Donald Trump. You get, well, at least if you are, I think, even-handed. I think there are nuanced ways to take down Donald Trump, if that's your goal, or to criticize him, critique him maybe if you're on the right and you're concerned about your political standing in your family, or if you're an elected official, your party, your electorate. The critiques of Donald Trump that come from different angles have themselves a different flavor. Some of those flavors we know are just unpalatable for about 36 to 32. 9% of the electorate, as far as I can tell. And, the thing that makes me, and this is going to sound hypocritical, The thing that makes me most angry is the people that fail to realize that their specific message is one of those unpalatable messages for 36 to 39%, 37 to 39% of the electorate. Those people are the ones, in my opinion, that have the ability to check themselves. And here I go. Basically calling Donald Trump supporters incapable of checking themselves. Today after Helsinki, I think that might be the case. And before we dive into the latest lagoon occupied by that big, terrible, wagging fish, Donald Trump, this time accompanied by Putin, before we dive in there, one more qualifier. When I say support, come on, this is obvious. When I say support, yes, I want whoever the president of the United States is to do their best. Their best being incredibly hard to define and something I myself could never do and couldn't point to somebody out there in the United States public, private or public sector, that could do it. Yeah, that's how hard the presidency is from my standpoint. No one's saying that Donald Trump wakes up every day to an easy job. What people like me are saying is that he wakes up and maybe just doesn't understand the dynamics that he's operating within. How he could really erase some really important borders. No beyond distasteful pun intended there. I'm talking about the borders that have been slowly erected and fortified and agreed upon by both the American public and whatever the current administration might be at any given time. And to point out some irony coming from my own mouth, the only other episode we did like this, called Gazprom and its Discontents, involved an hour-long discussion centered around Germany's basically unholy alliance with Russia when it comes to where they get their energy from. And Donald Trump echoed this very concern in the week leading up to this Helsinki summit, even though they don't really want to call it a summit. Trump basically says that, well, if you're going to accuse me of being in cahoots with Russia, well, you know, look at how I've operated, and then look at how Germany has operated. Look at this Nord Stream 2 pipeline they're going to build. Look how that's going to crop out the Ukraine. The Ukraine jumping on board with this statement. I'll get to that right in a minute. But there's Trump echoing a sentiment that I myself felt very strongly, you know, a couple weeks before he did. Even if the reason that he's talking about it is for his own domestic political reasons and just the fact that he really hates the fact that much of the current voting population feels that he won the presidency with the helping hand of Mr. Putin in Russia. Now, that I think is really at the heart of Trump's, you know, intractable nature over this issue, the fact that he can't pry himself from this Russia collusion scandal. You know, the investigation is still going on. Obviously, we don't want to sit here and pretend that Trump can completely forget about the fact that he's under investigation. His team, the people who got him elected, many of them are now under the eye of the FBI. But domestic political allegiances and interests aside, Trump did make a point that I thought was very much worth making, even if he did it for the wrong reasons. Now, this gets to the heart of many of the problems that I have with Trump. Sometimes he'll do things that I like, that I think actually help the situation at home more so usually than this situation abroad. You know, there are some caveats there that maybe we'll get into in some other shows. But even if it's not intentional, I guess I still appreciate the fact that something got done. Something that could potentially move us in a direction worth going. So, all of that aside, yes, I think the German Russian alliance over gas, especially given the fact that the former German chancellor is basically out there working for Russia at this point and forwarding this idea as something that's profitable for both nations, not just politically, but, you know, economically as well. Well, my apologies, former German Chancellor Schroeder. I don't really have any sympathy for that message, especially so when you take a look at CO2 emissions, how they look this year compared to last year, what zones of the world are now the leading culprits in harming our environment, as I think that is something that we should all be paying attention to, and the EU itself has committed itself to paying attention to this. Well, the actions of Germany, they don't align with the mission statement of the EU as stated all the time, as something that is really harped on by many EU administrations, something that we in America want our current administration to do more of. They're failing and dropping the ball across the Atlantic Ocean as well. And when you talk about CO2 emissions being increased more so because Russia is now more involved in the energy sector in the EU, well, then I really have a problem. And we're not going to recapitulate our first episode here, trust me. We'll move on to Helsinki in just a moment. First, I'd just like to quote a Guardian article. I think it gets us there even better than I could. A recent article over at theguardian.com, penned by, or maybe typed out by, Patrick Wintour, said the following in regards to this Nord Stream 2 pipeline, Ukraine, Russia, and Germany situation. He wrote, quote, "No country is more angry about the pipeline than the Ukraine, an ally Trump is supposedly poised to abandon when he meets with the Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki on Monday. Ukraine stands to lose billions of much-needed dollars if Russia can transfer its gas transmissions to Europe across the Baltic Sea, away from a pipeline running across Ukrainian territory. This week, the Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko said, quote, "This is not a commercial project. It is not economical or profitable. It is absolutely a political project. There is no point, from an economic point of view, creating this project. This is absolutely a geopolitical project." Wintour continues. By contrast, the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, has tried to maintain that the construction of Nord Stream 2 pipeline is a common-sense economic project with no political consequence. For many, her refusal to see the geopolitical implications of making Europe so dependent on Russian energy shows the reach that Gazprom, the majority shareholder in the project, has into Germany. The presence of the former German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder on its board and his friendship with Putin seems only to symbolize the triumph of Russian interests. End quote. I'm not an expert on German politics, nor will I pretend to be at any point. And I don't think that Angela Merkel deserves, the type of criticism that Donald Trump deserves. But this is beyond an equivocation here. This is something, this Nord Stream 2 pipeline. It does have political consequences that are quite real and easy to perceive. And, this goes back to something I talk about all the time. It's the expectation of blowback, even if it really won't, that is, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, even if it really won't hand Russia some type of really all-encompassing power over Germany, or more especially between the states that divide Germany and Russia, even if it doesn't hand that kind of power over to Vladimir Putin, it still will have implications when it comes to the people that think it does. And when it comes to this Donald Trump example we just cited, it also happens to give credibility to other actors around the world that want to point to Germany and say that they have some unholy alliance with Russia while they're sitting there getting the finger pointed at them, while Merkel tends to go largely unscathed. And back to the whole issue of nations that exist between Germany and Russia currently, right? I say currently because many people will point to the idea that Putin wants to reform the Soviet bloc. He wants to start expanding power. We've seen it in Crimea. We saw it in Georgia before that. Why is there any idea that he'll stop doing this? And especially so when we have an American president that is, in the eyes of most of the electorate, it seems today, very weak on Putin. Very weak. This is something that would just kill Donald Trump if it were to be said by somebody he actually listened to. Very weak on Russia's geopolitical strategies, interests, and their willingness to disrupt the elections of free democracies. Because that's really what I think this is about, too. Small point here, I'm one of those people that doesn't really think that Putin's essential goal in the 2016 election was just to get Donald Trump elected. It was to disorient the electorate itself, as to distract it from, well, whatever they need to be distracted from. Might it be Russia in the Ukraine? Might it be sanctions? Might it be just to promote unruliness that would leave the geopolitical chessboard somewhat unchecked? All of that seems a bit more plausible, rational, and under the capabilities of the Russian government, more so than deliberately getting Trump elected. And right there, that's the whole fear, that while this geopolitical chessboard is unwatched, unmanned by some democracy willing to put itself on the line when some large power decides to invade a smaller power, when self-determination is no longer the status quo somewhere around the world that we think it should be. Well, when this is all going down, President Trump doing what he's doing seems to promote the worst and most sincere fears that one might have of the former Soviet Union coming back into existence under a new name and a new economic order. Now, count me out of the group that thinks that this is a real possibility anytime in the near future. I'll let you go figure out for yourself how Russia's GDP stacks up against the rest of the world and the rest of the real economic players. It's not very impressive. Somewhere around Italy, right? That is the line that you will often see cited. But the parts of the economy that Russia does have some control over seem to be quite vital. So back to the Nord Stream 2 for a second, that's where this comes in again. So how will that interact with these nations between Russia and Germany? Well, as we said, the Ukraine's taking notice of this visit, commenting not just on Angela Merkel's whole deal with Russia, but also with, you know, the fears that Trump might do what he said he might do, that he might recognize the annexation of Crimea. I think you've heard Trump in the past saying something like, well, they all speak Russian. Well, if that was enough to get two countries to combine under the title of one of those countries' current titles, well, we might have some problems here in the United States. There's a country just to the north that happens to speak English. No one's thinking about combining with Canada. It doesn't actually seem to me like that's something that would please North Americans at this moment. Anyways, it seems as if this Helsinki summit did yield a Trump position on the Ukraine that I am satisfied with, Crimea specifically. He says he won't recognize the annexation. Well, good. And this does go along with some other things Trump has done to check Russia on the international stage. While I said Trump was weak on Russia, I certainly meant he's been weak in terms of what he's released to the press during this awful press conference he did with Putin himself. But, you know, you take a look at what's going on in Syria, you see where Russian troops have come under the line of fire of American weaponry, and you begin to notice that the risks that he's taking go a bit beyond what the rhetoric might suggest. You also see him really going after Iran, a Russian ally, over the course of his presidency, something he's always been pretty set on. So, when it comes to the Ukraine, okay, maybe that's off the table for the moment in terms of a secession to Putin. But where else might we find Russian-speaking non-Russian nationals that found themselves under control of the Soviet bloc, that bloc that Putin allegedly might want to reclaim someday, if given the right economic balance and power to do so? And as we've covered in today's episode, and completely in the first episode we did like this, well, that's been gas and oil and natural resources, energy. This is where Putin finds a lot of his financial might and power. It's not just the Ukraine that stands to be, you know, chewed up, by Russian energy interests and rerouting of different pipelines. It's countries like Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and Turkmenistan, not really between Germany and Russia, but existing in what Zig Brzezinski in his book The Grand Chessboard calls the Eurasian Balkans. I like that phrase a lot because, you know, the Balkans is something that's hard to understand for Westerners and the different dynamics that exist there, ethnic, religious, the intertwining of both into a cacophony of violence at any given moment. Obviously, there have been stretches where we don't see this type of violence. We see a Leviathan suppressing it, like the Soviet Union. Oftentimes, it's this type of situation in which we see a settling of the different forces at work in the Balkans. The Eurasian Balkans have historically had to deal with some of the same problems. And when we re-examine the geopolitical chessboard that we care so much about here at Political Dominoes, we tend to notice that the Eurasian Balkans, in the future, will probably present themselves as more relevant than ever before. It's not just the fact that they've helped produce the Huns and the Mongols and other tribes of history-bending power. Now they have gas in quantities that will draw interest from both China and Russia. Back to the geopolitical chessboard again. Now we have Russia and China with a mutual interest, with a shared interest in the same territory. And a zero-sum game begins to emerge in my mind as I speak these words. What could be the case if an unrestrained Russia were to meet up with an empowered and economically dynamic China over the Eurasian Balkans in the near future? I'd like now to turn to a book that concerns itself with this topic, not explicitly, but it talks about the future of what Zig Brzezinski called the Eurasian Balkans, this steppe area that exists between China and Russia, taking from Robert Kaplan's The Revenge of Geography, a book I absolutely love. He hits this problem with a hammer and drives it home for us. After some examination of how these states have formed, after the fall of the Soviet Union, which they used to be encompassed within, he writes the following, quote, "Sovietism and the lack of complete identification of each state with a single ethnic group has ironically led to a modest stability in Central Asia. Occasional unrest in the Fergana Valley and elsewhere notwithstanding, though I must say the region remains a potential tinderbox. This dynamic, buttressed by extreme wealth and natural resources, has given some of these states significant bargaining power with the principal Eurasian states, Moscow and Beijing, who can be played one off against another. Russia needs Central Asian gas to transport to European markets, which gives Russia leverage over Europe, but Russia's position is being threatened by China's own purchase of Central Asian gas. Central Asia's bounty is immense. Kazakhstan's Tengiz oil fields alone are thought to contain twice as much oil as the Alaskan North Slope. Turkmenistan's annual natural gas output is third highest in the world. Kyrgyzstan was the largest producer of mercury in the Soviet Union and has large deposits of gold, platinum, palladium, and silver. This wealth in natural resources, as well as lingering resentment over Soviet occupation, has led, for instance, to Uzbekistan opening its railway bridge to Afghanistan to NATO traffic, without at least initially consulting Russia, to Turkmenistan diversifying its energy routes rather than relying completely on Russia, and to Kazakhstan turning to European rather than Russian engineers to exploit its geologically tricky petroleum reserves in the Caspian Sea shelf." End quote. So, not all too much to worry about there. We see Kazakhstan developing itself quite nicely. We see the prospects of other nations in this Eurasian Balkans area peaking, at least in terms of post-Soviet structure and their economies. Actually, they're even providing some competition for Russia. If you're looking at this from a European standpoint, that sounds nice. But then you get to this idea that Trump put forward in the whole Ukraine situation. It's that Well, Kazakhstan has a lot of Russian speakers there also. If this is going to be the litmus test we use, there's some things we have to sit down and think about first. Kaplan continues, quote, Kazakhstan is a prosperous middle-income state by Central Asian standards that is geographically the size of Western Europe, with a GDP larger than all the other Central Asian states combined. Kazakhstan's new capital, Astana, is located in the ethnic Russian north of the country, which hot-headed Russian nationalists wanted to annex after the fall of the Soviet Union. He continues. The ceremonial building of Astana, designed by Sir Norman Foster, constitute a Kazakh rebuke to Russian ambitions regarding their country. The reinvention of Astana cost $10 billion. It is linked to the south of the country by high-speed trains. Kazakhstan is truly becoming an independent power in its own right. It is about to become the world's largest producer of uranium. It has the world's second-largest chromium, lead, and zinc reserves, and the third-largest manganese reserves, and the fifth-largest copper reserves, and ranks in the top 10 for coal, iron, and gold. End quote. So it seems here that a treasure chest exists between Russia and China currently when it comes to these Eurasian Balkans and the types of minerals and oil and gas that exist there. And one can only speculate as to what the future will look like in this area and whether or not these two giant powers will actually face off in some way, whether it be diplomatically or militarily, over this region. And to be fair, Robert Kaplan, the author of that last passage I just read off for you, he doesn't see this as a likely scenario. Caveat, though, this is before Russia decided to invade the Ukraine, right? This book was published before that incident occurred. And while we're on the subject of Russia invading its neighboring powers, I'd like to just point out something that I think is historically relevant and I think goes somewhat unsighted when we talk about this. I hear a lot of people, myself included earlier in this podcast, talking about Putin wanting to, you know, reform the Soviet bloc. Right? I think that's something I almost said verbatim earlier. And in a lot of ways, if we're going to talk about Putin specifically, from what I can tell and what I've read, it seems that he has a lot of, let's say, qualms, for lack of a better word, about the fact that the Soviet Union fell in the first place. This large, megalithic power, even if it was economically deficient, it still in many ways, other than communism, represented Russian power. And that's something Putin has a very acute interest in. And it's not just Putin. It's the communists that preceded him and the czars that preceded those communists. If you take a look at Russian history, what you begin to see is that, you know, basically since Ivan the Terrible, since after the Mongols and their Khans left the Russian territory, you see this unbridled expansion continuously unfolding throughout Russia's history. And this brings me back to that point I was referencing earlier that I think needs clarification. It's not just the fact that Putin wants to reform the Soviet bloc. It's that every Russian leader for the past, I don't know, three and a half centuries has sought to expand itself. And a lot of this energy for expansion, according to authors like Kaplan and Brzezinski and other geopolitical thinkers, has a lot to do with the Mongols. Anyone that's familiar with how the Mongols treated their occupied citizens can sympathize with that to some degree. Ever since this horrific time period for Russians, they have sought to create a buffer zone. This reminds me, to some degree, of the buffer zones that get created in ancient Europe, in ancient what is now Germany. The buffer zones between tribes, the various tribes that were living in Europe during that ancient time period, these buffer zones applied well to Russia as well. They had to fend off steppe nomads with horses that could operate in a way that left the Russians totally vulnerable. And the experience they had under Mongol dominion was a great example of something they never wanted to relive again. So as a consequence, you see various Russian czars, many of which are named Nicholas or Alexander, expanding their territory. That is until, you know, in the early 20th century, they meet up against the Japanese. But that aside, you see, once the communists take over, and this is what I like to emphasize when I go over this point, it's that you see this transition from an autocratic czar who is very conservative and somewhat reactionary and kills protesters and liberals and that whole deal. You see that change in Russia into a communist society and a communist government. Yet their goals are quite similar. Yes, if you want to point to the ideological strain within communism that seeks a world revolution, fine. Even if the application there seemed to differ a bit from the text, that's a whole other issue we're not going to get into today, don't worry. But the general geopolitical strategy never changed. You went from multiple czars that wanted to expand to multiple communist chairmen who wanted to expand, and then you get Boris Yeltsin. Maybe Boris Yeltsin didn't do as much as Putin's doing right now, but you know, eventually you do get Putin. Only a decade after the fall of the Soviet Union, we get yet another Russian leader who seeks to gain a buffer zone, seeks to gain territory in his immediate visible space. Not just the Ukraine, but the Eurasian Balkans as well. And this is what I think gets missed, not just in the everyday news cycle, which I've complained about already today, but when we talk about Putin's and Russia's expansion in the first place. We miss the Eurasian Balkans. We fail to recognize that it's not just the rerouting of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that's hurting the Ukraine. That's not the only geopolitical field worth paying attention to at this moment in history. Returning back to Robert Kaplan's The Revenge of Geography, we're going to go ahead and read a fairly lengthy passage here, which, you know, does well to explain both sides of this situation. You know, we're going to talk about, in this passage, Russia maybe not having any game to play in Kazakhstan or in the surrounding countries. But there is something else that's happening there that's worth paying attention to. I'm just going to go ahead and begin. Robert Kaplan in The Revenge of Geography wrote the following, quote, Kazakhstan will always have the option of turning towards China if the likes of Putin or his successor become too heavy-handed. In any event, the chances that Russia would be willing to suffer the international disapproval and diplomatic isolation that an invasion of Kazakhstan would precipitate are slim. In 2008, Georgia, a country 40 times smaller than Kazakhstan, with a third of the population and few natural resources, may have exposed the limits of Russian military adventurism. End quote. Kaplan then goes on to describe a situation that occurred in Kyrgyzstan in 2010, where that government decided to call in Russian troops to put down some ethnic tribal rivalries that we had going on there. Kaplan describes the soft use of its military force, Russia's soft use of its military force, as not to encroach upon the interests of Western nations there. But then Kaplan gets into what might be called the nitty-gritty of the situation. He continues, quote, Another restraining factor against Russian military action in Central Asia is China, whose influence in the region has grown at the expense of Russia, and with whom Russia shares a long border in the Far East. Reasonably good Russian-Chinese relations will provide momentum to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a group of which Kazakhstan is a member, which seeks to unite Eurasian powers, mainly autocratic, in an effort to counter the influence of the United States. The wages of Russian-Chinese enmity are greater influence for the United States and Europe in Eurasia. Thus, Russia will discipline its behavior in Central Asia and likely forswear any attempt to reclaim part of Mackinder's heartland by force. Mackinder's heartland there is a reference to another very early geopolitical strategist that Kaplan has been, you know, discussing throughout his book. So Kaplan there talking about a potential alliance between China and Russia over this Central Eurasian, largely autocratic territory. Something that we also in America should pay pretty close attention to. But before we pull the brakes on Russian military adventures in the Eurasian Balkans just yet, I'm going to go ahead and finish this passage I have here from Kaplan. Quote, "One word of caution regarding this analysis. Russia's hand may be weakened in Central Asia because of the rise of China and the desire of Central Asians to do more business with non-threatening, high-technology countries like South Korea and Japan. But while Russia's military options are somewhat constrained, Russia can still move troops around Central Asia in a way that no other power can. And Central Asians do harbor a certain nostalgia in these politically volatile times for the peace and security that was the Soviet Union." End quote. This nostalgia for the peace and unity, that's something that Americans and probably Western Europeans also don't give enough credit to. We wonder how, in Indonesia, we see ISIS gaining territory, and we see inroads being made by ISIS as well into Africa. And we wonder how this could be possible, how an ideology that to many Americans is utterly despicable could possibly gain any traction in these territories. Well, a lot of it has to do with the fact that order is very valuable. It might be more valuable to us when it comes from a democracy, a people's order, if you wanted to call it that. Well, a big, fat right hand and a fist is also another type of order, which, when there's no other option, might just be worth it. Kaplan also tends to foresee a China that will use other routes other than its military, to make inroads into Central Asia. He comments on it like this, quote, "In Central Asia, as in Eastern Siberia, China competes fiercely with Russia for a sphere of influence. Trade between China and former Soviet Central Asia has risen from $527 million in 1992 to $25.9 billion in 2009. But the means of Beijing's sway will, for the moment, be two major pipelines, one carrying oil from the Caspian Sea across Kazakhstan to Xinjiang, and the other transporting natural gas from the Turkmenistan-Uzbekistan border across Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan to Xinjiang. Again, no troops will be necessary as Greater China extends into the Eurasian heartland, the Eurasian Balkans for our purposes. The upshot of an insatiable demand for energy and the internal danger posed by its own ethnic minorities." End quote. Kaplan goes on to explain how China's interests in Afghanistan have grown and grown, and the erection of pipelines leading there is already being planned. This is the type of thing that, you know, really makes me sit back and wonder what it is that our current news cycle is able to hold, is able to carry with it. Now, I know that Kazakhstan to most Americans is something not worth worrying about, and I can understand that. I can understand how someone's focus might deviate from politics once you start talking about Kyrgyzstan, once you start talking about Kazakhstan, once you start talking about the Ukraine for many people. Totally understandable. Nations that exist outside of our Western European and North American enclave, they go largely unnoticed. But the consequences of not noticing them and not putting them at the forefront, at least some of the time, will eventually come back to bite someone. Whether that someone is Russia, after someone finally does something about Russia if they were to invade one of these countries, or whether it's China making inroads there that the US public hadn't found much interest in. Whether that culminates into a China that we need to worry about, the future will tell us. We know the media won't. So I think that's where I'll leave it for today, because I'm not going to sit here and talk about Helsinki in the same way that everyone else has. I don't approve of what happened there. I think if you do, you should probably reconsider your relationship to what you think Donald Trump is, right? I'm not going to sit here on this program and bash Trump supporters all day. I think there's enough people doing that, and I think for the most part it's counterproductive. But when you start to look at the situation that Russia presents itself as, I think it calls for an examination outside of how Trump is dealing with them. Okay? I think it involves looking at the whole Asia picture, whether or not Russia tilts towards Europe, that doesn't seem like it's happening. So what's the other option? It can't isolate itself. It's far too large, and it has too many big dogs in its territory to do that. It's going to go somewhere. If the czars and if the communists have told us anything, that's more than likely. Whether it's for resources or power. Ancillary point for the moment, Putin's popularity soared after his invasion of the Ukraine. So I guess the main point here is that we need to look at a broader context going forward. Criticism of Trump, absolutely fine, absolutely necessary. We should look for a better route towards stable democracies around the world, even if that's not what every nation has in mind. You can follow Political Dominoes on Twitter at Political Dominoes with no E. You can also visit our website, www.politicaldominoes.com. Same thing, no E.